podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello. This is the second part of the three-hour discussion had by Hillsborough survivors Peter Carney, Richie Greaves and Damien Cavanagh. As a warning, this part contains graphic details of what happened to each individual at Hillsborough in 1989. So please consider whether or not you should choose this moment to listen to this podcast. We start with Richie's recollections of the 15th of April, 1989.
So we left the ground that day. I'd been at Heysel 4 years earlier. So my old fella had had like a triple heart bypass, and I knew, I was aware of what had put my family through being there. So I was keen, once we'd carried someone who was critically injured or whatever down the pitch, I was keen to get to a phone and reassure my family that I was all right. And we made an escape probably about 4 o'clock through the south stand. And I remember walking out of there with my mate, and there was a load of Forest fans arguing with the police, saying when's the game going to kick off and all that. And I remember shouting at one of them, "There's fucking people dead there, you soft shite," what it like.
Yeah.
And then we carried on, and we come out by the Penistone Road end at the Cop end. And I remember seeing ambulances stacked up the road. That was always something that hit me for years later. All the lights and the noises of the sirens and everything, because there must have been like between 25 and 40 ambulances up the road. And the reason they were all stacked up was the first ones that got there, I think the ambulance fellas were running into the ground and leaving the keys not leaving the keys in the van and this, that and the other. So ambulances were coming and they couldn't get gain entrance to the ground, and the police were still telling them that we were fighting in the ground. So all the ambulances that could have saved lives were just stacking up Penistone Road, and we walked out right into the middle of that. And then we got on the coach to come back. And there was a few seats empty, and we waited, and then in the end, the coach driver said, "Right, okay, we've got to go." And I don't know whether those empty seats were people who died or people who were still looking for their loved ones or whatever, but
yeah.
We set off.
And what time was that?
I haven't got a clue about times, maybe 5 o'clock or half five. Mm-hmm. And then we're heading back to Liverpool, and on Five Live, they kept going over to the ground, and the death toll kept going up and up and up and up. And then I always remember a girl from the back of the coach running forward, like screaming, "Switch that fucking thing off." And then like the rest of the journey back was just silence.
Yeah.
And then I always remember I got off our coach, and I was standing there waiting for a bus to ours, and a coach full of Everton fans pulled up because they'd just come back from Villa Park by then. And I always remember the look of horror on all their faces, and they must have been like, I was the only one standing there at the bus stop, and they must have been like looking at me.
Yeah.
And everyone just looked, you've been through something and it's in your eyes. I always remember all the Evertonians on the bus like were absolutely like, it was like looking in a mirror, I suppose. And then I got back to buy ours, and I went in the pub, and I remember sitting there with a full pint, and people were coming in and out the pub. Obviously, you know, like people going on a night out and there was I could see cars going past, and I was sitting there thinking, fucking hell, life's just going on.
Yeah, that's me, Martin, isn't it?
I was like, what the fuck? Don't they know what's happened?
Yeah. I was like that for months.
Yeah, I was like, it's incredible. It's
months.
People are sitting there, and they were all probably talking about Hillsborough.
Yeah.
You know, people sitting there having a pint and
How can anyone?
But I was like, what the fuck?
How can anyone?
Yeah, I was like, what the fuck are people doing, and why is the cars going past? And then I remember I got home, and I went to bed. However long I slept. And then I got up the next morning, and I thought I'll creep into the lounge and like put the telly on and like find out. I won't wake anyone up. And when I got in there, my mum and dad sitting there crying their eyes out, and they said, "Do you think it might be as many as 100 knees dead?"
Jesus.
And that was my first, you know, of it, like, you know, the 12 hours after it. Absolutely. The horror. And then like when you see the newspapers and listen, like there was things on the telly. I went to the Paddy's Wigwam the next day. There was a memorial service.
Right, yeah, the Sunday, yeah.
And then we went for a drink.
Get in, could you?
Yeah, well, I got in there, but we went for a drink and then it was just mass sympathy, wasn't it? You know, everyone was sympathetic about what had happened, and then
so much love.
Yeah, there was. And even the Sheffield Star, I'd urge anyone listening to this to have a look at how they reported it
100%.
On the Sunday morning.
Yeah.
And they had about 8 or 10 reporters there in various capacities. They were like, you know, it was their version of the Echo. So they had people there who were just, you know, there to report on the traffic and the weather and this, that and the other. And they all reported it accurately what happened. But they soon changed the tune when their local police force started lying about us. And the first I knew about that was on the Wednesday. And my phone went, because you didn't have mobiles then, did you? It was just your house phone. So the phone went, and it was me mate. And he said, have you seen what's in the papers? And I said, no. And he said, the same, we robbed from the dead. We were drunk and ticketless. And I just put the phone down and I've always described that as like a hammer blow to us.
We knew Duckenfield
had lied, didn't we, on the day? But if there's ever a moment when it crystallises your thoughts and you think, fucking hell, they're putting the blame on us here, that was it.
I just didn't see it coming.
No.
I just did you?
I didn't see the paper before.
No, of course not. No, I mean, I'd never bought the paper in my life.
No, I've never bought the paper. No. I've never had any respect for anyone who did buy the paper. Yeah. It's a fucking rag. It's always been a rag.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I mean, it was just a rag going to even deeper depths of despair, you know, to protect their own. That's the way I thought of it. And I was made up to see them burning it and caving.
Oh, yeah. So, do you know
and
what?
You know, again, people bouncing back from the, you know, from the depths of despair, if you like, to, you know, to say, I'm not having that. You know, I'm going to make something, you know, I'm going to make my point.
And that's the point I'm making about being from the community, standing tall. Even people who weren't there, they knew.
Yeah,
because they knew us.
They knew instantly.
Their flesh and blood.
Had gone back with the tears, like what you're saying now, you know, and told people what had gone on. So who do you trust? You know, people around here are not going to read the Sheffield Star. But, you know, who are you going to trust? The Sunday Express or the lad next door? You know,
most papers lied about us. Even the Liverpool Daily Post.
Yeah, the Daily Post. Yeah.
No, but I mean, in the instance, what did you said about the Sheffield Star on the Sunday and what have you? But you know, and there's loads of examples where they told the truth about what had gone on in the pens, and you know, where eyewitness accounts and what have you, as it really was in the very first instance in the thing. But Liverpool people generally and those who were close to Liverpool supporters had first-hand accounts, had their own, you know, trusted accounts of what had gone on, and that, you know, that galvanised our community, if you like.
We've had, after the collapse of the latest trials, we've watched senior QCs stand in front of the cameras and go on Five Live and talk about there not even being any kind of cover-up. But in them immediate hours after the disaster, you know, you've seen the likes of Paul Middop, who went on ITV, and he was all over the media saying that, you know, this drunken mob had turned up late and killed the innocent people that arrived early. And, you know, that narrative had formed very, very early on with them.
While we were still on the pitch.
Well, people were still dying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
supremely
powerful, what they did to us. Yeah. They had all the power and they made sure they used it.
We're saying
propaganda.
This, and what I'm trying to say to you is the other side of it was, our side of it was that we had the power to tell each other what was going on, and that is the basic root of everything that we know about our experience. That is it. It is our experience.
Yeah.
And other people close to us took that on as being so. It wasn't added to, fancified or what have you. You tell me, anyone who's gone round, you know, bragging about, you know, what they done on the pitch and that, you know, there was 1,001 heroes that day, but probably a lot more, who, you know, literally saved lives. And you know what? I can't wait to see the day when somebody says, yeah, look, we've had a little look into this, and I'm telling you now that if it hadn't have been for the help, because if you look at the, they can do it. They can work out from the hospital records and all stuff like that in the same way that they did from the medical records.
That's a great point, Peter.
And I'm telling you now, I've chased it from the word go, because I still to this day don't know, and I long since given up knowing who it was that got me out of them pens, how it is that I got from them pens to being out on the back terrace. I don't know, and I long since give up on finding out who it was. It doesn't matter. What matters is that it was Liverpool supporters. It was honest to God, it really doesn't matter. What matters is that in my dire moments of need, those who I love to be among helped me out and saved my life.
Peter, though, if you can explain to the people who are listening what happened to you, how you got out them pens, and
I don't know. That's the point. Yeah. Is that I don't know. You know, there's a gap in my life. The first pictures I found of myself in the pens was about 5 years ago, and I was taking tickets down to cards down to one of the lads who goes in the match with us, and he said, oh, I've seen your pictures there, Pete. I said, pictures? What pictures? The Hillsborough pictures. This lad, Vinny, he lost his cousin, Carl Lewis, and he said, the pictures from Hillsborough. I said, what pictures from Hillsborough? So he goes and gets his phone, he taps his phone, he goes and puts this picture in front of me face, and there I am in the middle of the fucking picture. My head is at shoulder height to everyone now. In fact, I'm a liar, the first one. It was a sequence, and it starts off where my head is the same as everyone else, and I just go down. There was four of them. He showed me, I said, fucking hell, Vinny. I said, I've never seen them before.
It's shocked, yeah, I remember.
And I was blown out, honest to God. I was blown out. One of the things that really struck me is how far down the terrace I was. No, because I always thought I was higher up. And I know I was watching Gary Parker played for Tingy, and I was watching him. You'd imagine the line on the edge of the penalty box. He was running in the straight line, basically, not parallel, what you say when it's the same line, as if the line was continuing, the edge of the penalty box was continuing up the pitch. I'd seen him twice looking at that. I was looking round the ground, because I switched off screaming at the coppers, and I just thought, I've got to get my breath together here, you know what I mean? It was a waste of breath screaming for my life. And I kept looking round to change my view, you know, just to be sure my head was going on. I switched off from the noise and that, because all I could hear was people screaming at the coppers, asking them to save their lives. There's people dying in here. A fella next to me was going purple and blue. In the end, I went through a near-death experience, and I watched myself being crushed in the crowds. I was at like 10 o'clock. If you imagine a clock, I was at like 10 o'clock on the clock looking back at myself in the pens in a perfect circle of people. Now, while I was in the pen, I felt like I was head and shoulders of everyone above everybody around me. And when I looked back in the pens, I was head and shoulders below everybody around me. And there's a perfect circle of people crushing me, and I'm going down, and I thought, what about Tina and the baby? And that's the last conscious thought I had. I'd actually watched myself going down a tunnel, you know, and the best way I can describe it, it's like a tube of cotton wool, an emptied out tube of cotton wool, and I'm going down it, you know what I mean, and I look back at myself, and there I am getting crushed in the pens. And what about Tina and the baby? And the way I rationalise it is that I hit the floor and got under the legs of the barrier, And I got some air that way. I must have done, because it, you know, kept me alive. I think that the illusions when you lose your oxygen and your blood and stuff like that, that's what's going on. But a survivor months later was studying, Pete Rankin was studying psychology at Liverpool University, and he brought a chapter of a book in to the survivors group, and he said, yeah, I think you'll find that interesting. And when I read it, it was about out-of-body experiences and near-death experience, and it had bullet points of how you identify somebody who's been in a near-death experience. And out of 10 bullet points, I hit 9 of them from my experience. Well, that was dead helpful to me because then I was, you know, understanding what it was I was going through. I thought, you know, it was an alien experience, you know, I'd never known anything like it on this earth. And I think what happened is that I fell between the legs of the barrier. The legs of the barrier were like a letter V upside down with the bar across the top. And I think I fell in between them because I must have got air. I certainly didn't fall under a load of people falling on top of me because I must have got air. And the next sensation I have is if I'm being pummeled on my chest, on my torso. I can't feel my arms and legs, but I feel like I'm being banged on my torso. And I, for many a year, thought it was people passing me back over the edge above the crowd, but there's no footage of anything like that going on. So it might be that somebody's given me CPR, but I don't remember anything on my mouth. You know what I mean? Just this thing on my torso. The next sensation I have is of me back to the floor and my arms and legs outstretched. And I can feel my limbs now. This is the first time I can feel my limbs and my arms and legs are outstretched and I can hear noise and it's an echoing noise and I can get vision. I've got vision and the vision is black. And I think that that's the tunnel. I think I'm being carried out of the tunnel.
That's what it sounds like, doesn't it?
And that's what it felt like. You know, that's the only way. I don't know for sure. The next thing you know, I'm out the back and for donkey's years, I thought I was lying on my right hand side and I couldn't have been. I must have been lying on my left hand side because I was facing away from the stadium, looking at the wall at the back of the ground and I've got no focus. I can hear noise. I can hear, sirens and stuff like that. And I'm looking at the wall and the wall's changing colour, it's becoming red and I've got all these different things of red and it's like red brick. You know what I mean? And then I see, coppers standing in front of a dead body with his t-shirt pulled over his head and his body's bloated. And I thought to myself, fucking hell, is that all you're good for? You know what I mean? The copper mines and the dead body. And then the next thing you know, the lads who had gone in the match with Mick, he comes out and he shakes me on the shoulder. And again, for donkey's years, I think it was about 16 years, I told the story like I experienced it, that he shook me on the shoulder and he looked at my face. And as he looked at my face, he realised I was crying because I can remember feeling the tears running down my face. And he realised I was alive and had me moved. So I got moved then to against the back of the stands, you know what I mean? Well, 16 years or so later, I met Mick in Kirby and we were having a pint and that, like, you know what I mean? And he said to me, you know what, Wach? He says, don't you tell that story about, when you come out of the ground? He says, that's not how it was, you know? I said, you what? He said, that's not what happened. I said, well, what happened? He said, he put his arm, he said, well, what happened was, he said, I put my arms on your shoulder. He said, and I looked at you in the face like that, and you said, don't fucking touch me, I'm fucking aching all over. I said, yeah, well, that's all right, mate. Sounds, yeah. I said, well, that's the way you've seen it, mate. I'm just telling you how it felt to me, you know what I mean? And that's the way that I've always told it, because I didn't know. And I still, to this day, don't know the time lapse of that. And you know what? I'm not asked that. I don't know. It could be 10 minutes, could be 20. Well, it's not 10 minutes. It's between 20 and 40 minutes of my life that's missing. You know what
so
I mean?
For all the people that have said to you over the years, move on, why don't you fucking let it go?
I haven't stopped moving on. I was left for dead on the terrace, so everything from there is moving on. This is where the experience, I think my experience is a little bit different from everybody, from a lot of people, you know. I'm not saying it's distinctive. I know quite well it's not distinctive. Neil Fitzmaurice was on one television thing one time and he explains about going through a near-death experience as well. And I'm sure I'm not the only one that was left on the terrace carried out unconscious. I know for a fact I wasn't. You just have to go to the hospital records to find that, you know, and you'll find that, you know, there was other people and it's not singular. But what I think,
that's who I go to match with, who you know faces off from where, you know, what we do.
Yeah. They were in the same boat. Well, that's where it was. So when people say move on, get over it and stuff like that, you know, you're talking about, you know, you know, I'm left for dead on the terraces. I've been through a near-death experience. You know what I mean? I've been beyond the living being that I knew living being could be. You know what I mean? So what do you mean, move on, mate? And in the first place, you know, when I was thinking, and I wasn't sure whether I was thinking that it was real, that it was right, and that went on for a long time. So, you know, I had to reorder my thoughts. My blood, my brain had been deprived of oxygen. That's the way I think of it, you know what I mean? So when having to recover that and get that stabilised and what have you, I think it was about 8 weeks before I stopped aching. And part, you know, and that's just the physical injuries. I didn't have no broken bones or nothing like that. They wanted to keep me in the hospital overnight, and I said, "No, listen, mate, I said, I've got to go home." I said, "You know, I'm not good here. I didn't want to be fucking staying in hospital. There's people a lot worse off the
light." Any survivors that kept in overnight had the blood alcohol level taken,
only that Mick was with me. He said, we told him, you know, Mick was the driver. Like, we'd gone in Mick's car because it was a 5-seater. I was supposed to be driving the 4-seater, and Mick decided he was going on the day, so he drove. So the doctor said to him, "Well, look, you go and get the car, and then in the time it takes you," he said, "we'll see how he recovers." He said, "You rest, and we'll see how he recovers." He must have been checking my blood pressure, mustn't he? You know what I mean? I think that's what was going on. He said, "And if there's, you know, if it looks all right," he said, "we'll let you take him home, you know, so long as we know you're taking him to his front door and he's gonna rest," you know what I mean? So that's what happened to me. But when people say about moving on, you know what I mean? And the other thing in all of this in the very early years and that thing was I wanted to know who'd helped me out. So I was actively, you know, I sought the reassurance of what other survivors had gone through and what have you, you know, to normalise my experience. And in that, I wanted to know, I wanted to thank someone for, you know, for saving me life, you know what I mean? You know, so that was what was moving on to me, you know what I mean?
I've got like a related experience on the other side of this with you, Peter, in that. You don't talk about, you know, talking about you were aching for 8 weeks later. You know, I didn't have that. I had two physical injuries from the day. And one was a bruise in the shape of a hand on my back, which I didn't know I had until my mum showed me the next day. And you could see the finger and the thumb marks. Now, I wasn't struck. That's just someone's hand in my back and the pressure in the pen.
Yeah.
And the other injury that I had was like a little nail cut on my the index finger of my right hand from when I pulled an advertising board up. And talking about what you're talking about in you want to know, but it doesn't matter about who was helping you.
I give up on it. I give up trying to find out.
Same, but on the other side of it, so wanting to get stuck in on the pitch, and the advertising boards were extremely wobbly. It was like, it really surprised me. I was even expecting this.
Plywood.
Yeah. Really, you know. So I pulled an advertising board myself. And it was a young boy. And I say a young boy. Mm. And he might have been a year or two either side of my age. And I was 20.
Yeah.
His colour wasn't good. His eyes were closed over and his mouth was open. He wasn't moving. I had him somewhere in the middle third of the pitch, if you like, but I couldn't tell you where exactly. But towards the stand with the clock on, if anything.
A shout stand?
Yeah. So I put the advertising board down, and there's a busy with me without his helmet on. And another lad who was defo younger than me. And we all sort of waited for a second. That takes forever. And so I pulled this lad onto the board. I don't blame the policeman for that, by the way. I know he's supposed to be trained, but again, you're dealing with some extreme circumstances, aren't you? Dealing with this, you know. And at least he was there, and he was helping us. Mm. Wasn't obstructing us. There was no abuse from this guy. And you've got to call these things in the way that they are, because that's all the story.
Mm.
So we carried him up to the other end of the pitch, where to the cop goal, and I do remember hearing the applause of the fans. So at this point, the Forest fans understand that there's serious problems, and they wouldn't be, they hadn't dawned on them at first. And so we left them in, I think, in the penalty area at the cop end. And if not exactly there, extremely close. And I'm very, and I'm positive with that.
Mm.
And we were just waiting for the cavalry. We were waiting for all the St. John's ambulance. We put him at the, out of all the chaos by our goal, this young lad had been taken out of the chaos. So goes back down the other end and looking round for another board I can get up, another person I can do, another, what can you do? And there was none of that. So I went over to a busy with a cap on and not a helmet, so he wasn't a constable. And I remember saying to him, is there anything you'd like me to do? And he said, no, we're looking after everything now, thanks.
Mm.
But he said it to me nice.
Mm.
And he didn't have the disdain for me, like the two coppers at the perimeter fence.
Mm.
And so I escaped through there. I walked out. So I was like, what am I going to do? I've never been on the pitch before. Mm. So I walked out through the players' tunnel. Ended up making a phone call to me mum and my mate's parents. And then that was that. In all that time, it never occurred to me that I would ever know who that young man was.
Mm.
In my heart, he died.
Mm.
I don't think he made it. No cavalry came when we laid him down. So I don't know which person that is in the 96.
Mm.
And then when the 20th anniversary come out, the front page did all the pictures on the front of the Echo. And I was like, gulp. I'm going to know who it is.
Mm.
But then I had kind of probably the most common dark hair, maybe a little bit of a muzzy, maybe, I don't know, I can't tell you about that, sports top of some description, certainly not a shirt and tie, do you know what I mean? Indistinctive of the clothes that we were all wearing at the time, and jeans. And as I pulled them onto the advertising board, I remember his kecks coming down, and you could see his underpants, and it never occurred to me it was important that anyone knew anything, really. I just sort of, you know, you just got stuck in and that was that. And I've never been worried about it. Now, it turned, you know, after the panel report, one of the medical things was, and it was Kirkup, wasn't it, the medical guy?
Yeah.
He said one of the last things that did take the last lives of it in moving these people, moving them, you've took the last breath out of the body.
Mm.
But I don't feel guilty about that because if I hadn't moved them, they're dead anyway.
Mm.
I didn't know how to do CPR at the time. I do now because of, you know, football coaching that. Mm. You know, you might, and I thought at the time, by the way, CPR was magic tricks. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I thought all that, but just to finish on that, Peter, and we've had an experience with this.
Mm.
After becoming a dad, I then thought, I would definitely like to know who's trying to help my lad.
Mm.
I would like to find him, and I would like any pieces. So I made my evidence available to the solicitors.
Mm.
And they didn't do it that way round. They didn't like try and find me on the pitch and then follow me around. Mm. And the footage is extensive, but it's not comprehensive.
Mm.
So it's like there's gaps. So what they did was, in my understanding, was those who were unlawfully killed, they looked at where they were and then looked at their movements. It's not like they looked at someone who was trying to rescue anybody and then followed their movements.
Yeah.
And so I've never come across it. And it was never important to me who it was, because all it was important was, you just get, it's a human thing, isn't it? You just get stuck in. I didn't save anyone's life. I haven't saved anyone's life in my life, ever. But all he did was get stuck in, but he understood the value.
If he hadn't got out, it'd have been a little less shit.
Yeah, I get that too, you know. So, on the other side of it, I then understood the value of a parent wanting to know who touched their son, who tried to help, who might be able to give them 30 seconds, and I've probably got about 90 seconds tops.
Mm.
I had first hand of that.
Yeah. And I met a mum, a bereaved mum, as you know. And about the first three or four questions, we were ticking every box, and the underpants decided it. How mad's that? The type of underpants that her son had.
Yeah.
But the look on that mum's face during that time when she thought she might finally have someone who could piece
the
something
blessing,
together. Yeah, it was, you know, and I understood the importance, but then I also was like, I don't want to go round for this because I might find another mum whose hopes might be built up, who might be going about her business, and I unscratched the wound, and it's not the answer.
Yeah.
And so for that reason, I've never gone any further.
I think that that's one of the for me, I wonder whether that's one of the really difficult areas moving forward about recognising what I call the greatest act of spontaneous human compassion that this country's witnessed since... I don't know what the one before that was, but
there wasn't
the way
one.
The people like yourselves, you know, responded and helped people out of the pens and what have you, you know, was absolutely remarkable whether they were helping those who later died or helping people like myself who survived. I always remember Tony Barrett at the cathedral at the press conference for Anne Williams asking me what it felt like to know the 41 people that were killed could have survived if the rescue plan had been put into operation properly. I said, well, that makes me number 42. And it does, because it was only, you know, it was only by the helping hand of Liverpoolians that, you know, that I survived. It's a simple fact, you know what I mean? And that's how I feel about it. But I think going forward, if we're going to recognise, you know, the remarkable, you know, response of Liverpool supporters in saving lives, I think you're walking into a tricky area as well as what you just mentioned there, is knowing that some of the actions of people there didn't help. You know, were actually detrimental to, you know, people, whether or not they survived or not, meaning to say, you know, if they hadn't been moved, they might have stood a better chance of surviving and stuff like that. So that's, for me, going forward, that's one of the difficult areas that we need to look at. But I think for the greater good, I think that we should look at them areas, you know.
No, I do agree.
Because, you know, it was the most remarkable act of spontaneous human compassion that this country has ever witnessed.
The obscenely high number of 96 is only as low as it is because of...
That's what I'm trying to say,
Of everyone getting stuck.
And, well, I feel like, that, you know, that I'm living proof of that. You know,
You've only got to look at the pictures on the pitch, haven't you?
Yeah.
The police forming a cordon across the halfway line.
Yeah.
Who's carrying all the...
What I'm saying, Richie, is that, you know, for many years, because we've been, you know, we've had to try and find out what went on and that. Well, who was responsible for this and what actions did they take and stuff? We focused on those that didn't, you know, those that were responsible for it in the planning, preparation and the, you know, the enactments of the events and stuff like that. And then the failure of the rescue services and, like you say, and, you know, responding. Well, we know that they, you know, their actions were responsible for 41 people, you know, dying or certainly a good number of them, 41. I think that that clouds the positivity of, you know, the lives that were saved. Because, you know, if we hadn't have acted when we did, if the Liverpool supporters hadn't have acted when they did, then, you know...
And don't forget, a lot of Liverpool supporters that narrowly escaped death moments earlier.
Well, that's why I say it's not the greatest act of spontaneous human compassion.
Yeah.
The, you know, I seen... I wrote that phrase on the back of an envelope on the morning we went to the cathedral for the hip report after watching John Ashton explain what had gone on at the back of the terrace. I think John Ashton put hands to me because he organised a triage at the back of the stadium. So that's as close as I've ever come to knowing anyone who contributed to my rescue and recovery. And in watching them, I wrote that phrase, the greatest act of spontaneous human compassion this country of Evan West ever witnessed, on the back of the envelope that contained the invitation. And you know what? Nobody has contradicted me yet. No. Nobody has come up with an example. I still don't know what is the greatest act since. I don't know what the one before was. Maybe Abervan. That's the only one that I think might be able to come near. Maybe there was things gone on with that disaster, you know what I mean? But yeah. I don't know. Maybe it was the Blitz. I'm not sure. But, you know, I'd like to think that I'll be around to see the day when that's acknowledged, when we can say to people, listen, we know what you've done that day, because here you are. We're not following the dead here to find out how they died. We're following those that tried to help out. And it has to start from those that we know that have died, because within that, like what you're saying there, Damien, is people who've tried to help, you know what I mean? Well, that, to me, that's a hero. That is a remarkable thing to do. You just fought for your own life, you know, or you just stood there and watched people being killed in front of your eyes, and what do? You jump up and say, I'm going to have to help out here.
Yeah.
Well, that's remarkable to me because, you know,
yeah.
you know, That's a fantastic thing to do. That's what we should expect of you. And that, to me, is an innate thing that you want to help somebody who you see. You talked before about them coppers. Not one of them phoned the head's office and said, listen, I think there's a few people in trouble here. Now, I know for a fact that there's loads of people by me screaming for the life at one particular copper who I was looking at. All they had to do was
call a major incident. The fire brigade would have arrived with the cutting equipment.
I'm just talking about the basic human instinct of saying, I can see people in distress here.
Yeah.
That would come further down the line. I'm talking about the basic human instinct of whether or not you help someone out or you ignore them or what have you.
Yeah.
And that copper in front of the fence who I was screaming off in my life and loads of the army was screaming off for the life, he didn't even have the decency or the nous to realise that people in front of him were in, how could he see it? You just mentioned them photographs that are being taken. He's standing there looking at that and doesn't recognise that people are in distress.
Well, I tell you what, someone like that needs some medical mental help.
Because if you can't see that kind of distress.
We talk about the front page of the Mirror. They've seen it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. He sees that and then he doesn't pick up his phone.
No.
His walkie-talkie and say, listen, there's people in distress here.
They looked at us as some kind of like subhuman.
Yeah, this is what I'm trying to say to you. And so the other end of the spectrum is that people who were in them pens who were suffering that distress, as soon as they can relieve that distress themselves, they then set about helping others.
I agree.
I'm
grateful for that picture in the Mirror because it shows to the world. I mean, you know, the busies would have denied all that, wouldn't they? But that showed the horror. It's incontrovertible truth, isn't it? But yeah. I would like to think if I was a cameraman, I'd have took that picture and then I'd have put my camera down and I'd have got stuck in.
By the same virtue, I know now who one of the fellas is. And I've never mentioned it to him, but it's always in my mind when things are going on up and around the grounds and what have you and what have you. And I know who he is. And you know what? I swear if I get half a chance to do something about it, I will do. But I'm grateful for that photographer for showing that picture because that picture encapsulates the rescue to me. Them lads, there's eight of them on it, isn't he?
Yeah.
All carrying that board across the pitch.
Yeah, if they went taking the photos.
So that's their job and they're in that zone.
And where that come to the fore was at the Warrington inquest because both legal teams had access to over 5,000 photographs and that came from those photographers. And they also had access to hours and hours of video footage from inside and outside the grounds. It was from the BBC cameras that were there to record the footy. It was from the Sheffield Wednesday's CCTV.
Yeah.
So Hillsborough was the most filmed and photographed disaster ever in the history of the world. All that footage was there. And if you imagine when the South Yorkshire Police lawyers take the case to the inquest in Warrington, for the longest running inquest in British history, 25 months. And during that 25 months, they weren't able to produce one single photograph that showed any wrongdoing by Liverpool supporters or one single frame of video footage that showed any wrongdoing. So the only evidence that was being put to the jury of any wrongdoing by Liverpool supporters was verbal evidence, verbal shite. By the South Yorkshire Police.
By self-interested agents and things.
And we're sitting there watching these people stand in the witness box every day for 25 months telling us, spewing out the same filth. And what I went 3 days a week, so I'm sitting there and I was in the HJC end of the courtroom. So the witness is facing you. So we've got the likes of Midup and Gordon Sykes and all these gobshites actually looking at you while they're lying. And you're thinking, this is incredible. Please, let the jury see through this.
Mm. And, I can't believe how young they all looked.
The
jury.
Yeah.
And how much weight on them. Just looking at them going, my God, This is life and death for people, this. This is genuinely life and death. But there are people who are not going to be able to get the other side of this if you call this wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can I ask you a little bit more about your experience with the inquest, if you don't mind, Rich? Because you said before that you stood up twice. And that's a lot to sort of put yourself through, I think, especially a second time when it's obviously not gone well the first time. And Damien mentioned before about, you know, you've got these highly paid, highly skilled people who are there to catch you out, basically, or to try and make you stumble. And that's a big thing to sort of put yourself through, not once but twice. And also I would imagine the pressures of feeling that, you know, you the people you're representing, I would suppose.
Well, yeah, I mean, when I first gave evidence in Sheffield in 91, that was a real horror story. I drove up there on my own, and I sat outside the court on my own, and like 10 minutes before I was due to go in to give my evidence, someone come up to me and like shoved me statement in my hand and said, yeah, I'll read through that, you're on in 10 minutes. So I couldn't read it. My nerves had gone. I was only like 24 at the time. So I go in, and then it was one of them old, you know, an old courtroom, like all oak, dark oak
panels.
Panels. Yeah, it was really intimidating. And then you've got the judge sitting there with all these, not the judge, the coroner, you know, with all these people around him and all that. And we found out after that one of the people, that his right-hand man, was Stanley Beachy, who Damien will tell you.
Oh, about. Me, yeah.
Yeah, Damien's mate.
Got his autograph twice, yeah.
And he was deeply involved up to his eyeballs in
corruption
with the West Midlands Police Serious Crime Squad, which was disbanded months before Hillsborough. And he was put on non-operational duties on the run-up to it, but found himself as the coroner's right-hand man at the inquest. And he was put in charge of basically any Hillsborough survivor.
Part of that corruption was to set a fella up called George, I can't think of his surname, who was a good friend of Anne Williams, and they set him up a post office robbery years before, and George won the case over him. Just to balance the books or balance the view, George was a great help to Anne Williams, Beachy was a great help to Popper.
No,
it's a real.
So West Midlands Police settled out of court for conspiracy about fitting this fella up.
That's right.
So we.
What was his second name, George?
Is it Compton? Compton? Can't remember. Don't know.
It's a real horror story, isn't it? West Midlands. So anyone that wants to Google what went on the run up to Hillsborough and the fellas that were involved in the West Midlands Police supposed independence investigation into Hillsborough, just look at the West Midlands Police Serious Crime Squad scandal. Yeah.
And I don't know the fella's surname, but the case is there, and he settled out of court for conspiracy for fitting him up.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a fact. And then he's all of a sudden, he's there, the right-hand man, and you're right in the firing line, Mitch.
Yeah, so the coroner says to me, name and address, blah, blah, blah. I give me name and address out, and then next minute, they're taking the mickey because of my accent, and there must have been loads of other survivors who gave evidence before me. But they had eight barristers all lined up, and they all had the white wigs on, and you know, all in black, you know, when you're in this surroundings, and seven of the barristers were representing South Yorkshire Police, obviously West Midlands Police, Sheffield Wednesday, the FA, you know, everyone's against you. And you knew one of them was representing the families, but you didn't know where. I walked in there not knowing, like, when the questions were coming at me, I didn't know who was the one on our side. And they're saying, were you pushing outside? I said, no, I just like joined like the back of a crowd of people, and like we were just waiting to go in the ground, and you must have been anxious to get in there. I was, well, yeah, you know, so you were edging forward, you were pushing the people in front of you. I was saying, well, no, as people went in, we all gradually moved forward. Was there an aggression amongst the crowd? And it went on and on and on, you know, like they wanting you to say you were pushing. That was their whole case, wasn't it? Outside, we all turned up late.
So was it just one that was quizzing you, Rich, or did he take a piece?
I can't, that I think that line of question came from one, and then somebody in the family's section jumped up and says, "How many times are you going to ask this lad the same question?" And it was all put to a stop and all that. But my, you know, all my wheels had come off by then. I just wanted to get out of there.
Yeah.
So I left there, and for years later, any mention of Hillsborough, I just shut down. I just, you know, the way you just go cold. And,
I went at least 15 years without being able to say the name Hillsborough.
Yeah,
I'd call it Sheffield. I'd call it the disaster. And then as for the skull, I couldn't even wear the "Don't Buy the Sun" sticker on my shirt because I didn't even want the name on me.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Even "Don't Buy It."
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? Yeah. I couldn't do it. And I'm hugely proud of what you did, Rich, with the inquest, because
brilliant.
I'd have had rings on around me. I did the slaughter of me mates, but you just stood there. You did it, and you did it again. You know, when I'm not, you know, I got pulled as a witness. I know that I did. And it might have done me a favour. It might have set me further back in my young life. And my evidence comes out in a media campaign. So maybe that was better. Mm. Or maybe not. I don't know. But your courage and your strength.
To do it again,
like you've said there, you know, how dare they ask you again? But you were ready for them.
I wanted to do it again.
Yeah, exactly,
because
the
verdict that come out there was in Sheffield was accidental death. And lots of the family wouldn't accept the death certificate. They wouldn't accept it while it had accidental death on it. So my mind was made up then, like anything I could do to help the families. And people say to you, well, why have you carried on this fight for, you know, 32 years now, isn't it? Why haven't you let it go? Like we were saying before, it's exactly because of that. I could never let it go while I could say something that maybe helped the families get the proper verdict on the death certificate, unlawful killing. I would keep fighting, and so that was why I went back to Warrington. And Warrington wasn't as bad because I think people had recognised how horrific Sheffield was.
Yeah,
and it was supposed to be. We went into the Warrington inquests, and it was supposed to be non-adversatorial. You know, the police had already admitted that Liverpool supporters were in a fault and blah blah blah, and we went into it just thinking, yeah, this is it, you know, it's just to find out how the individual people died. And what happened? The police turn up again en masse to a man and lie through the teeth. So instead of the inquest being 5 or 6 months, which we were all told, it lasted 25 months, and it became the new longest running inquest in British history.
Yeah. Overtaking the first one, which was the longest running British inquest in history.
Yeah.
And you know, that's one of the issues now, isn't it, about the new law that they're proposing with the Lord of Candor, to have all public officials, you know, legally bound to tell the truth to any inquiries. And stuff like that, because they regurgitated the same old discredited lies time and time again.
I went to Dachau about 4 years ago, a concentration camp near Munich, with me wife. And as soon as you get there, there's like an eerie feeling about the place. You know, like bad things have gone on there, don't you? You can just feel it. And I think birds don't fly over it, do they? There's like... the whole place just like stinks of what's gone on. It was an incredible experience going there. Yeah. And the tour guide that took us round, halfway round, we went into this room where survivors had done paintings of what had happened.
Yeah.
And I thought that was so powerful for me. I thought, imagine if Hillsborough survivors could do that. And
somebody haven't seen them. I know of survivors that have got artworks that they've done and they've exhibited and stuff like that. But, you know, they haven't been seen them. And it's another point going forward that I think that needs to be uncovered, you know, is how people, what ways people have found to manage the experience, and I think art and craft activities.
I ended up speaking to the tour guide.
Yeah.
And saying, like, there's so many, if this was only halfway through, I said, there's so many parallels with Hillsborough. And he ended up, like, being obsessed with, like, asking me questions. Mm. But, you know, the vilification of people, the, you know, and you can see it in every other disaster that's taken place with the British for years, you know, Ballymurphy, Grenfell.
We went to
Showban. You can go on and on and on. All these disasters where
we went to Leicester after when the it was my birthday, the 1st of May. So that was like 2 weeks and 2 days after Hillsborough, you know. And we'd already made plans before Hillsborough happened that we were going to see some friends. And my sister was living in Leicester at the time, so we were having the bank holiday weekend there. The bank holiday was the 1st of May that year. And I always remember explaining to this friend of mine what had gone on. And he said to me, he said, it's the showers. I said, you what? He said, it's the showers. I said, what are you on about, the showers? He said, the fucking showers. He said, that's what they told the Jews. They were getting a shower. He said, they led you down the tunnel and told you were going somewhere safe. I said, fucking hell. You know what I mean? Drawing a parallel between the experience of those that were killed, you know. Fucking hell, I'm a fortnight after the worst day of my life, you know. He's telling me that, you know, my experience is comparable to Dingy, you know.
It is our thing, isn't it? You know, it's our, you know, struggle. It's Liverpool's darkest day. I mean,
it's the worst day of your life, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
That's the
way
it is for so many people. Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm sure people have got personal experience.
That's why we've got compassion now for people that go through similar things, isn't it? Like Manchester Arena and all these other...
Oh, as soon as you see it, you know, your heart leaps, doesn't it? You know, when you think, oh, no, not again, or whatever. I mean, I think about now and, you know, me nan wouldn't talk about the Blitz.
Mm.
May 1940. And you think about that, you know, and all my family going through all that as well.
Mm.
It does make you understand these things a little bit more in a way that you could never have done. And I wish that none of us did have to understand it in that way. And it does make you look at other things. I mean, you heard about other disasters or other human stories.
It's not
about
the roses, is it?
No, it's not.
We all have our own things. You know, that's the way it works out, isn't it? You know, something will come along. You know, there'll be spanners thrown in your life's work. And when it first happened, I mean, for the state that I was in, you know, I wouldn't have had Liverpool kicking a ball again. You know, that's the way
I was prepared to sign Liverpool FC there and then.
I'd have given Everton the chance to play the cup final against Forest or what have you. You know, I'd have been all right with that, you know. And whoever won the league, give them the league. You know, I'd have been glad for Liverpool not to kick another ball till, you know, till August. But once they said that, you know, they were going to play again, I said, well, I've got to go again. You know,
that's where I was.
And it was Old Trafford. I'd been at the cathedral for the service on the 29th, and a lad who helped us make the banner, John Fay, he went to Glasgow with the banner because we were going to Leicester, so I wasn't going to Celtic much. To be honest with you, I didn't want to go anyway, you know what I mean? But, you know, so he took the banner to Celtic. He was made up to get back involved then. But I think the first one that I went after Tingy was the replayed semi-final at Old Trafford. My abiding memory was that I was banging on the hoarding above the tunnel, you know, the way you have that. It was a metal hoarding anyway, the passageway come out, you know, the steps come up, and I was above it and on the metal, and I'm banging the metal. And my mate was looking at me as if to say, fucking hell, you've lost it, you. Because I was giving it full bifties, you know, the team coming out, because we had to win then, you know what I mean? They're playing again. They had to win again, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's why you play to win, you know what I mean? Yeah, but that was the first time back in the grounds. I'm saying the first time. I've since checked it back, but they were playing West Ham. And I was up on the top, the right-hand corner, halfway up the cop, as you look at it. There was an entrance to come out from the toilets at the bottom. very close, the bottom steps were very close to the back of the Albert, where the boys' pen used to be.
Yeah.
And anyway, I was up by there, and it was 0-0 at half time, and I gets back in the crowd and I had a panic attack, and I'll throw my ass around, get me on. I always remember this, still see it in my mind's eye as I speak, this fellow with an MPTE jacket on, he must have been a bus driver. And you see the fear of God in his face, you know what I mean? Anyway, I get out. I thought, I can't go out the ground. See, the gates weren't open, like, by then, you know, say, like, 55 minutes. It was just after half-time. And, you know, I could have asked to go, but I thought, I can't leave here now, because if I leave here, of course, the gates open. Oh, now's your chance to get. No, I can't leave here. And I tried to look over the crowd and that, like, well, I'm not that big, you know what I mean? That was a strain, and that's what I done, just trying to have a nose and that, like, and Liverpool was struggling to score, you know what I mean? I thought, you know what, the only way I'm going to see Liverpool score here is if they get a pen, and sure enough, they got a pen, and I stood on the side of the walkway, took two steps, jumped on the wall, clung onto the wall on the other side, looking over my shoulder like that to see John Aldridge score the pen, yeah. Mm. And Liverpool won one, and I went, yes, yes. And I knew I broke the ice, you know what I mean, because I hadn't gone out to the grounds.
Yeah.
But, you know, and Liverpool had seen Liverpool score, you know what I mean? But
that was the first game back at Anfield?
I think it was. It wasn't the first one. It was a couple of games.
It was a penalty late on.
Yeah, West Ham.
Yeah. I walked out the ground.
Was that the first one back?
Yeah.
But after that, so. I went down the bottom then.
We got a pen. We got that pen. And everyone cheered.
There was only minutes left, wasn't it?
I just, like, went into
buckets. Long left, was
he? Yeah, and there wasn't long left. Yeah. The game was going nowhere, and we had to win.
Yeah. Because they had no energy to see.
No, the team, and everything. But yeah, I was in the cop over towards by the main stand. Block 102, it'd be called now.
Well, that's where I was.
Yeah, yeah.
We up there, yeah.
He's a little
yeah.
close where we had
always all this time. Yeah.
And I just... I went to the replay semi-final.
Yeah.
Cheered all the goals.
Yeah.
Wasn't a bit of a good journey and have a walk alone.
Yeah.
That's fair enough. But when that penalty got awarded late on and the crowd cheered, I was like, we've got nothing to cheer for.
The West Ham one.
Yeah, they just, and I walked up the grounds and I just walked to Kirkdale Station.
It was only 5 minutes.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I didn't want, and I heard in the background the cheer that we'd scored. I knew we'd scored.
Yeah.
But I was just like.
Well, you didn't see the pen?
No, I walked out, I'm not having to do it anymore.
No. Right.
And then I made myself go the remaining home games, and I made myself go the replayed semi final, and I made myself go the Goodison game.
Yeah, I didn't know,
and I made myself go to final, and then
that was our first game.
Did you go back in?
Yeah, I went. Yeah, Goodison was our first game.
Yeah, Goodison was our first game back at Anfield as well. Yeah.
Is that the 5th of May?
If you were taking Hillsborough out of it, that's what cost us. We weren't going to beat Everton after how good they were, and all that. That was played out as a pre-season friendly.
Yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and
the West Ham game wasn't much different.
Yeah, no, and it's all about that.
But football was irrelevant then, wasn't it?
No, I felt that, and I felt a duty to go, and then it was like, well, what do you do? What have I always done?
Yeah.
And then obviously, what allayed me mum's fears, for example, was it's all over the telly, they're taking the fences down, it's on news at 10.
That's right, yeah, and they put the mulch
and all that. But even the moat wasn't up for the end of the 88-9 season. Right, the moat was for the following season.
Yeah.
So I was like, all right, well, we have had the summer and all that. And,
Go back in then, Richie? Where did you start again?
I was back in straight away.
Yeah,
you didn't bother you.
That Everton game, the first league game back, I was in the park end.
I was in the Glad Street.
Which was quite similar to Leppins Lane, really, wasn't it? But without the lateral fences to make it into pens.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've always shared that, that park end.
It's horrific.
Yeah. Well, before Hillsborough changed me, I went to Hillsborough in 88 for the semi-final, and then I'd blown all my money there and couldn't go to the midweek game against Forest, the 5-0.
Yeah.
And then, like Tom Finney said, it was the greatest.
That's right, they were brilliant. Yeah,
I never went to that.
Let me tell you, Richie,
that was one of the last home games I ever missed. I thought after that, fucking hell, like I'll never miss another game again.
Yeah.
And I've only ever missed them now because they're like debt in the family or something like that since then, because I'm fighting the missing one of them.
That was the second hour of this three-part special with Damien, Richie and Peter. Huge thanks to them for their honesty. Please think about the people you may choose to share this with and their well-being. To reiterate, should you have any concerns about your own reaction or well-being, please remember, you can call the Samaritans at 116 123 or visit them online at samaritans.org. You can text SHOUT to 85258 or email joe@samaritans.org. Or for the campaign against living miserably, you can call them on 0800 585 858 from 5 p.m. to midnight every day. Or visit their web chat page, thecalmzone.net/help/webchat. Or you can access a range of information and support on mental health at www.nhs.uk/mental-health. Thank you, and par free soon. Sports Social Podcast Network.